Welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 11, Part A, Vanity Chats, the podcast where everyone is striving for what is worth having, a fun discussion. My name is Magellan, and I wish my co-host would sing for me. It's Alan.
Oh, hello. Oh, mate. Oh, I will gladly sing for you. Here I go. Oh, there once was a man, he's a drunken sailor. Oh, it's a man, he's a drunken sailor. He's drinking and he's going sailing. He's a drunken sailor.
You vaguely stuck to the tune of that. and I applaud
it. It was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, mate. It was beautiful. All of our British listeners are dropping their patronage as well.
My British child voice is just Pinky from Pinky.
The English is an invasive species, so it's fine.
Yeah. We're also joined, that other voice that you hear, we're also joined by our dear friend and co-host for all of Vanity Chats, who I hope doesn't fly too high or she'll leave the rest of us behind. It's Old as Your Omens.
Oh, that's actually really sweet. Thank you.
Yeah, it's sort of a weird way to compliment
Becky,
someone.
It's meant really, really bitterly.
Rodden's face is full of fear when he says that.
Yes.
To her, yeah.
There are a lot of lines in these episodes that you read them on paper and you're like, wow, that's nice. And then you watch them and you're like, wow, that's not nice.
Yeah. So we watched two episodes of Amazon's original, sort of. I mean, how original is it? It's a book from the 1800s. But
it's an adaptation.
Their 2018 version of Vanity Fair. This week we watched episodes 5 and 6. We're going to talk about episode 5 first, in which battles are won. Nope. Is that right?
Yes.
This one's right, but the episode 6 title's wrong. So we got to fix that before we do the second half. First, we'll talk about episode 5, in which battles are won and lost. Written by Gwyneth Hughes, directed by James Strong. It originally aired, as with all of the episodes, on December 21st, 2018. In this episode, the Battle of Waterloo gets underway with George in the thick of it. Becky spies an opportunity to profit from the war by selling Rodden's horses to the cowardly Joss. Oh, man. All right. So what did we think of this episode overall, in which battles are won and lost?
Well, I didn't know what I was getting into with these episodes of Vanity Fair, to be honest with you. But I was surprised by this one. I think we actually moved the plot forward in some surprising ways. It's a couple of jumps where I feel like the adaptation is skipping really crucial plot details. But overall, I think this is where a lot of the budget went, right? We're getting the war scene. We spoke a little bit in Chats and Prejudice about how, man, we hear about a war brewing, but we never get to see it because that's not what the story's about. And, you know, Vanity Fair is not exactly about that, but it hovers around the Battle of Waterloo, and we get to see it in crisp, high-definition, widescreen, long-shot, 1917 could never detail. And I thought some of that was good and some of that was deeply silly, but I want to talk about it.
It's so, so good, and it could 100% be played straight, but this is Vanity Fair, and it's narrated by Michael Palin.
Yeah.
And they take the, sort of slapstick nature of this show to its fullest extent.
Yeah.
I think, while also having it be like a really deep and dramatic point. Like there is somebody, there's adjacent to everyone kind of being a little bit silly, there's a guy literally disowning his daughter and saying she is dead to him.
Yeah, the drama doesn't really happen on the battlefield here. The battlefield drama just affects what is much more interesting to us, which is what's going on at home with Amelia and Becky in their separate corners of the universe.
But the same episode can hit such high extremes of comedy and tragedy, and I think that's really beautiful. It works pretty well, and quite often shows that try and do that kind of contrast can find it really difficult.
But the thought that I had when I was watching this episode is just how naive it was of me at the end of the last one to talk about, like, oh, okay, Becky's done some bad stuff. She's going to learn the error of her ways and start to get better. And that is not the case. Becky descends deeper and deeper into her greed and her whatever you would call her social climbing. I don't really know what the base sin is there, but she delights in the game she plays with people in this episode, and it only gets worse in the second one. But
oh yeah,
I was curious, John, about.
I would use the words manipulative narcissism.
Okay.
But
that's a good diagnosis.
She is. What I love about Becky is she's also got very gray motivations.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially at this point, right?
Yeah.
Like, sure, at first, it was one thing to say, I'm, a poorer member of society, or I don't want to be consigned to be a governess for the rest of my life. But at this point, it's like, what do you want now? You are out of that position, and now there's not really any sort of morality to what you're doing. It's more about vengeance, or at least a big part of it is, especially her sort of game playing with all the horses.
And it's about the thrill, too.
Right. So
she's
like
creating stress for herself.
Right. So like a big plot for Becky in this episode, everybody else is at war in the battle, and she seems completely dissociated from the looming danger of that, or the possibility that Rodden could die or anything like that. She doesn't really seem that affected by the conflict. Rather, she has his own private horses, and she's making the rich folks who look down on her run in circles to try to buy the horses off of her.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this scene where she's talking to some fancy lady.
Lady Barracres.
Lady Barracres.
Was she in the previous episode?
She was.
What was her thing?
She's rich and mean.
Becky okay. and Rodden okay. and tried to make everyone else hate them too.
And this is the scene where I think Becky, she's done some bad stuff, but I think this is the scene where it's fully like, okay, you know, Becky has been possessed by the symbiote suit or whatever, and we're going to see her be evil for a little while. Because she basically makes Lady Barracres, she's like, okay, what are you going to give me? And Lady Barracres is like, okay, I'll give you money. Well, what else are you going to give me? Oh, I'll invite you to all the cool parties. And then Becky's like, I don't care about your cool parties. Get out of here. There's nothing.
I just wanted you to give that to me so I could say no.
Yeah, exactly. And then she looks out the window and watches her cry, and it makes her very happy. I was like, oh my God, this sucks. Oh no, Becky. No, no, no.
Michael Palin says at the beginning of the episode, a war isn't so bad as long as there's money to be made.
Yeah.
And Becky takes that to heart and says, it's time to get mine.
Yes. You got yours, so why don't I get mine in every single little bit of chaos that ensues here?
She's basically like...
She's a war profiteer.
Yeah. I was going to say she's the 1800s version of Uber. Like, she's price gouging these horses.
Yeah. I saw that you had written that in your notes.
Uh-huh.
By having the exclusivity to the only horses that can get you out of London, she can charge whatever she wants. And so she does that with the Barracres, and then she tries to convince other people. Eventually, Joss spends way, way, way too much money, and he's like, yo, I got these horses. Does anybody want to come with me? And like, Amelia's like, ugh, and O'Dowd are both like, I kind of don't. Like, my husband might still be alive. I don't know yet. He's like, but I bought four horses. And then him and Isidore like leave with these really expensive horses, and it's so sad for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he gave Isidore his French military jacket, because Becky manipulated him into cutting off his little rat mustache and his braided coat, because he looked quite the French military man. And he wouldn't want anyone coming for him, would he?
Mm-hmm.
But really, it was just get that fucking thing off your face.
Right. I thought that all that stuff with the horses was very funny. And then just in case you weren't sure that this is about greed, Becky literally like throws cash in the air and lets it fall on her face. Like, yay, I'm rich. You really need to just be... This episode's not subtle at all.
No, not at all.
She's greedy, but she's also like, it's hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and
she doesn't.
Those are almost two separate behaviors.
Yeah, she doesn't want money to buy things. She wants money to like have the status of having being money. Wealthy. Mm-hmm. To her, like rolling around in a pile of money is what the money is for.
And yeah, that's something that comes back later when it's like, you have money you could be spending to help people and you're choosing not to. This is a problem that is going to bite you in the ass multiple times. But we also get war scenes, as we mentioned earlier. This episode, directed as previously by James Strong, is going for what most, like, you know, 1800s war scenes are going for. Giant green field, bunch of soldiers in blue and red. You know who the good and bad guys are. It's very clear. It's very quote-unquote epic, if you want to call it that. This is like how you film a good war scene of this time, right? This is when war was still fought with human beings with guns that have bayonets on them. They run at each other, they shoot, they say fire, they all do it. They go rank and file. I'm curious how much of this was actual soldiers and where there's CG, because I'm certain there was CG in here to like fluff up how many soldiers were in this. The Battle of Waterloo was a lot of people and very violent.
I think they had about maybe 100 to 200 actual actors and extras in there. And they sort of made up the two main companies of 50 people that were the ones getting shot at. And then there were other regiments also on that field, and they were all CG.
Yeah.
And Google when they did the long shots, that was all CG.
Yeah, those big sweeping shots, establishing shots, seemed CG to me.
CG. Google tells me that overall, Wellington's army here was about 118,000, and Napoleon's army was 73,000. So definitely lots of CG in there. But it mostly works. I wasn't thinking like, oh man, these effects look bad. It's just that you can't, you wouldn't film with that many extras for an Amazon special.
And in terms of like the narrative of the story, we focus in on one regiment and one company that these men are all in together, which helps us sort of frame the story for a little point, which helps.
We are watching this battle happen from Dobbin and George's perspective, who are now leading their own regiment. And for a while, the camera doesn't even dwell on them. They're talking about pushing. They feel like they're losing for a while. It goes back and forth. And then we get a final push. The French army, we think that the French army has given up. They crest over the hill. And then Dobbin orders all of his soldiers to fire. They all start to go to do it. Everything is going great. But the French are shooting too. And what's that? George takes a bullet to the face. Dobbin is completely frozen.
To the chest.
To the chest, rather. Yeah, I was like,
Yeah, not his pretty, beautiful face.
No, never.
That remains intact.
Dobbin is literally paralyzed. And you get to that classic war thing where somebody is like in shock, but everybody else is like running past him. I always think it these like men running at each other, there's a reason they don't do this anymore besides the dehumanization of conflict, right? It's so messy. Like, what if you run over your own dude? People are literally trampling their own men. For sure.
They are trampling their own men to death. They are wounded. Nobody can get them off the field. It's the U.S. actually, I think, improved on this during the Civil War. But it's so, so disgustingly bloody. And that's part of the reason the Napoleonic Wars were like that equivalent of World War One or World War Two.
You're just throwing bodies at each other at some point, which is what war is. At least it's nakedly honest, and as opposed to the like depersonalization, like I said. But you know, they do a really good camera moment here where George falls over, and as he falls over, the blocking replaces him in the shot with Amelia waking up because she's shocked because she knows something has happened. It's really, really well done. And then again, not subtle, a white dove lands on her window. You're like, did you get it? Are you paying attention?
this whole, I mean, everything about this show is in your face. It's like, just so you know, like the part where Dobbin is out there on the field and there's the guy who's like been injured. And he runs out to pick him up and then brings him back. And George looks at him like, whoa. The show is like, hey, just so you know, Dobbin's a good guy and George is growing as a character. Did you get it?
Did you get it?
And then later, this injured guy, when Amelia talks to him, is like, how's it going out there? He's like, oh, it's rough, but don't worry, George is alive. She's like, wow, that's great. And then they are tending to his wounds in the bed. And the guy's like, by the way, just so you know, Dobbin is the coolest guy in the whole world. If there's anybody who's awesome, it's Dobbin. Dobbin is freaking incredible. The show being like, just so you know, he's a good guy. And then Amelia blankly looks out the window and is like, so anyway, is the battle over?
It's basically like we basically won, right? Like everyone's going to come back. They should be back soon. Yeah. And it's this final push that leads to George dying.
Yeah, that's like, I feel like we need to sort of come back to the idea of this book as a satire.
Mm-hmm.
And the like really sort of the over the top framing devices that it employs.
Exactly.
Like it's all, I like to think like, oh, it's just children playing when it gets that obvious, but it's also kind of on the nose for television, and the framing device isn't specifically explained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Sorry, go ahead.
So it kind of makes no sense, but that's kind of my home base.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point because, this isn't a straight-laced, sincere story, but they're presenting all of the war stuff totally across, or whatever you want to say, like totally straight across the plate. There's no sort of tone to it or anything. They're just like, okay, we're doing the tropes of war. And yeah, in the absence of some sort of frame or some sort of greater emphasis on the fact that this is satirical, that just ends up being this really anodyne war story where you go through the tropes. And I personally didn't find that it particularly compelling. Like all of the war and battle stuff I actually found kind of boring because it was like so typical.
I skipped through quite a bit of it.
Because it's like the show's not really making a point about it. And I think it's also hard because like there's not really much of a point to be made about it that I can think of. Like, what's the story of the Napoleonic Wars? It's just two European countries who were fighting. I don't know like what the angle is on that. And like the battle is a boring way to do a battle. And I don't know. So it was that, I think, out of everything in the episode is what worked the least well for me, precisely because of what you're saying, Omens, that it's sort of like, this just feels very rote and tropey because it's not contextualized in any way, really.
George died and I laughed hysterically.
I honestly did. It's kind of like, it's so rote, like you're saying, John. Like, it's just, they do the thing that you've seen in every war movie where they run at each other and the one guy you care about goes, and then eats it. And the other guy goes, no, and then that's it. And then the war is over. And like, you asked earlier, like, what is the sort of value of something like including the Napoleonic Wars in the story? Or what is the angle of like in choosing to frame it in this battle scene? And, in the broad sense, as I understand it, the French succeeded mostly in the Napoleonic Wars. There was a lot of domination over continental Europe at the time. And this was after disputes that weren't resolved because from the French Revolution. So the British win the Battle of Waterloo, which pushes Napoleon back. But the characters that we care about don't make it, or at least one of them doesn't. So overall, the war is happening, but it doesn't affect our characters that much. The relationship between the French and the British does, and that's like the initial angle of Becky's whole thing, is like this weird French girl coming to England and trying to like mess with our system of doing things the right way.
Interesting. Yeah, so I guess in a way the arc of Becky's story, you're saying, mirrors the fate of the French in the Napoleonic Wars, where like they're surging forward and then get routed and ultimately lose.
Is that kind ultimately of the story? Lose, but then kind of achieve by Thackeray's time, rocky existence, kind of like a rockily stable existence.
I gotcha.
And I feel like you definitely hit on something there.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, guys. I read a book one time, and now I don't have it.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy. I'm curious. I'd love to look and read like literary criticism on this mm-hmm. book to see that more yeah. fleshed out.
Vanity Fair, like the literary criticism surrounding it, is almost more fascinating than the book itself.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
It's mostly ideologue or not ideologues. What are the words for like tropes given form? Like people that are tropey. Characters that are tropey.
Crap,
don't know the word. Sorry.
What's the word? Oh my god, I'm blanking on it too. Oh no, what's the word for when a character is like a type of person?
Archetype.
Archetype. Is that archetype. What you're saying, Omens?
Yes, archetype.
Oh wow.
But it's very archetypey, and Becky herself is sort of the archetypal social climber, and the situation mm-hmm. she's put in. Mm-hmm. Are those archetypal situations, but it's all very up to 11.
Yeah.
And again, right. I always think like you compare her and Mr. Pitt to like Jane Eyre and Mr. Rochester. Like Mr. Pitt isn't hot. Mm-hmm. He's old and he's gross.
He's this lecherous old guy.
He's just like living his best life, being a little bit evil. And Becky is also a little bit evil, and they like each other because they're a little bit evil.
Yeah.
But and I feel like the reason Becky doesn't marry him is one, because she wants to travel and have sex. Let's be real. Same. And two, because she just doesn't want to, she wants to be respectable mm-hmm. in some capacity.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so much of this and so much of her fight as a social climber is a fight for respectability, which no one will give her because she is French and because she is mm-hmm. the daughter of a painter and an opera girl.
And we see that paralleled with Amelia here. Speaking of the show not being very subtle again, I actually appreciate how kind of economically it can use its cinematography and its dress to move us forward in the plot really quickly, because we basically hard cut to Amelia chops off a bunch of her hair, dons a black mourning outfit, and this is all conveyed with like dress and acting and performance and camera work. Like, you don't need to know that like she found out, she cried for a whole day, and then she had to start getting ready for the funeral. It's like, no, we're going there, we're doing it fast. And then Matilda is the one to break the tension, and she says something like, oh, it was entertaining at first, but I'm bored with the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, we won after all, didn't we? And it's like just contrasting the callousness of somebody like Matilda with Amelia, like having her heart and her family broken.
Yeah, the worst thing to ever happen to her in her whole life.
This is Amelia suffering her first tragedy of many.
Oh, of several. Oh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Matilda is just over here like, I could give any less of a darn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Here's where I thought that I wanted a little bit more detail, but the lack of detail kind of made it funny. Mr. Osborne tells like Dobbin, who's grieving, that Amelia is dead to him and he won't support her baby, which is like really sad. And then Becky just has a kid. At some point, Becky and Rodden had a child. A whole baby was born.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was meant to imply that they had sex right before the Battle of Waterloo and Becky was pregnant all throughout that. And then they have like a 6-month time jump.
Okay, so we just did that to suggest the time jump, is you had a whole baby in that. Okay.
Yeah. Because they just need to get to Amelia has a baby and Becky has a baby, because that's the next interesting thing.
Yeah, right. And Becky is a terrible mother. Please call child services. And Amelia is deeply devoted to her child. It's more, honestly, that like I don't think Becky knows what to do with a baby, because no one like did that.
Right.
Her parents
worked,
goddammit. She's drugged and left to fend for herself.
Yeah, she doesn't know what to do, but also she does not give a fuck either.
No, she's not trying to learn.
Even if you are sort of raised, or you know, there's an absence of parenting that's a good example for you, I think people who really give a fuck can still figure it out. But Becky just doesn't. want to. I don't remember what exactly she says. Oh, it's when she's talking to Matilda, who's dying in front of her. And she's like, now's my chance to be honest with someone because you're about to die. So I can confess this to you. Like,
Everything's gone wrong since I left.
I never wanted a kid. Whoops. Anyway, hope you left us some stuff in the will.
And it's only 100 pounds, which is enough for like a maid servant to live on for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you're a maid servant, that's like really, really, you can gamble the wages of a maid servant away in like a day and a half.
And and so money kind of becomes the conflict here. We went from war problems to money problems, as it usually goes, right? So Matilda dies, and Becky's kind of dealing with like having a child and seeing like where are Rodden and I going to move in? They're literally on the street, being like, "We need to live somewhere." She really hopes that she can just easily slide in the DMs and move into Matilda's mansion.
And Rodden's like, "What is wrong with you? We can't just move in." Here.
She's still warm. And you're like, I want to put the furniture over here. And he's like, and then she makes her first unfortunate money decision, which is that they buy an apartment on the assumption that she's going to get money from Matilda's will. They spend too much money on an apartment. It's a pretty nice apartment, honestly. And then they get the hilarious scene where they do the will reading and they get literally 100 pounds and Butte and Martha get all the rest of the money, which is bad for them. But they still attempt to rent the apartment. But how are they going to pay for it? Well, we have a nice game room over here. Rodden, you're good at gambling and lying, and I'm good at being sexually coercive to people. Let's just invite all of your war buddies over, continuing to be a war profiteer.
Scam them for years.
For years and years, and we'll pay our rent by scamming people. This is such it's so scummy. It's like gross to say it out loud.
Yeah, it is.
Like when you put it that way, it's gross. And Rodden wants to go along with it because she says it nicely.
Yes.
But
At this point, Rodden has no interest.
Sorry. Becky is hoarding money.
Yes, big time.
Uh-huh.
She still has all the banknotes she got from Joss. She's lying when she says the money is all gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exhausting, shall we say.
Yeah. It all starts to blow up.
Perpetually be duped because he's a good dude. He's a really good dude.
He's doing his best. And
justice for Rodden.
And at this point, Rodden just has no interest in the schemes anymore. He's going along because it makes Becky happy, but increasingly he wants to
settle down with his kid. There's a moment later where he's like, "Oh, I felt so bad for them." And she's like, "Wait, who?" And he's like, "Our son that we have." Our actual child that you birthed. What, do you not remember?
Yeah. And there's some wild stuff with that in the second episode, but in the first one, after another time jump that's like years and years of a jump, like probably what, 6 years or 5 years or something?
But
around that much. Becky is now playing the piano for this gambling this gambling house that they've set up. And their son walks in and immediately she gives this icy look to Rodden of like, get that boy out of here. And Rodden goes and picks up the son, takes him out, and he's like, "Oh, you know, I'm sorry. You know that you are going to get in big trouble if you interrupt your mom while she's singing." And the thing that I said at the beginning, he's like, "Oh, I wish mommy would sing for me." It's so sad. It sucks. No,
he's never received any tender emotion from his mother at all.
Yeah, ever. But also it's, again, the show having absolutely no sublety whatsoever.
Becky is a narcissist, confirmed.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think the parallels between Becky and Amelia are compelling in this episode and in the second one. They are painfully obvious, but they are compelling, because you'll cut from Becky neglecting her son to Amelia, like, you know, swaddling her son in his bed or something like that. Or you'll cut from Amelia out on the street, trying to sell her paintings, and the guy's like, sell me your shawl, and then she sells the shawl, and then it cuts to Becky being like, I'd like to buy one of your giant feathers for the ball, please. That's in the second episode, I think, but anyway, it's just, yeah, I was curious what we thought about Amelia and the Amelia-Becky parallels in this first episode.
Poor Amelia is just too good and kind for this world. She Literally. Needs other people to support her, and they just want to use her for their own needs.
Yeah.
And it's horrific.
Yeah.
Because she just wants to do right by everybody, and she has been told all of her life to do right by everybody, and people are just using her.
Yeah.
Whereas Becky has grown up knowing that she was going to be used, and is therefore going to use others. And people get mad at her because she's a woman doing these things.
Of course. So I don't want to like be unfair to Amelia here, but I do still remember in episode one where this naive young girl, and this is a girl this is who she grew out of, right? She says, I'm so happy with George. Like, we're going to be together forever. I love him. I wish everyone else could experience this happiness with me. And it's just, she's so naive. Like, there has to be a middle ground between Becky and Amelia, like having a worldliness and being able to cope with financial stress without being a criminal and without being a charlatan and a horrible person. Because Amelia, like, things just happen to her, whereas Becky makes things happen to other people. And I think that's the key of what, like, splits them apart so much here, as they, similar things are happening to them, but they're dealing with them completely differently.
And it's sort of, I think, maybe a core critique you could make of the satire of this story, that it's inherently saying, it's obviously, I mean, there are obviously many rich characters in the show that are bad people. But it is sort of fraught to talk about the sort of purifying effect that privilege had on Amelia, and the sort of like corrupting effect that need had on Becky. Because obviously it doesn't work like that, but it's an interesting duality nonetheless.
I still think the show is building to saying that Becky is going to end this show destitute and Amelia is going to find happiness. I still have that like optimistic hope. I don't know. But I think that would be a good conclusion.
You want to see Becky destitute? So, that's your hope?
Like, kind of.
Knowing how the beats of the story go and how they were mimicked, mm-hmm. you're right. But there's something at the end you're still missing.
Okay, great. I love that. I remember you said last week Mary there's a Becky third option.
Get married to each other.
Yeah.
I would be okay with it.
I really wish.
They would finally be able to work with each other. Becky's plot ends with her in this episode meeting Anthony Stewart Head, the vampire, Lord Steen himself.
He did look like a vampire.
Absolutely. He looked like an armored vampire. His like button up and everything looked like armor, and he looked like he had a cloak and he was going to bite her neck. He probably has bitten her neck.
Spike in the 1820s, honestly.
Yeah, basically.
Like, I know he was sired in the 1890s, but who cares?
Wow.
Thank you for yourself. For predicting those emails coming in.
Yeah, wow, great work. In French, she says she's enchanted to see him, and then we have the really corny cover of Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. You can't.
You can't. Is now a good time to issue us?
Can we slowly talk about the fact that like Amelia is just ill this entire episode?
I was about to roll back to Amelia. I wanted to ask y'all questions about Amelia.
I just wanted
to get through the Becky stuff and say that the Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. What were you saying, Michelle? This is time to issue what?
Oh, just on the topic of a song choice, we should maybe issue somewhat of an apology to the choice of using All Along the Watchtower as the main theme of the show. Because we were talking before the podcast about how, like, the carousel, I mean, it's more of the show just being, like, very on the nose, right? But the carousel is a sort of, you can't get out of this situation. You're stuck going around and around. And then All Along the Watchtower is a song that is a kind of circular narrative song. Mm-hmm. And it seems like it was chosen for the line, there must be some kind of way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. And like, you know, maybe Becky's a thief or a Joker or something. So like there's something there. It's still dorky, but anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Amelia has some troubles in this episode. Specifically, I was a little bit confused, and I'm wondering if either of you can clarify for me what was going on with her husband's sister. who like wants the child because she sees him and tells her father, she tells George's dad, like, oh my god, he's so beautiful, and he's got this spinning image of George. And
okay,
then they
I
let
can explain this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so Jane, who is played by the fabulous Ellie Kendrick,
Jane's great.
She was Nadia in the Life and Fate audio drama, which I highly recommend if you want like 8 hours of Soviet war stuff.
Okay.
Just all full right. out communism and fascism are the same. It's really well, if they are totalitarian. But anyway, really good actress. And she is essentially trying to, because she realizes that Amelia is destitute, and Dobbin sent her a letter, like, I really wish they had a friend closer than me who is 5,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Jane Osborne goes to their house, looks at the kid, and begs her dad to, like, take him in and educate him. And that was actually a common thing. Like, if one of your relatives was poor, you would take in their kids
mm-hmm.
and make
mm-hmm.
sure that they got educated and that they lived with you and that they had, like, good clothes on their back and they were taught good manners.
So this is basically them saying, you can't take care of your own child, we'll take your child for you?
Yes.
I see. It's interesting. Well, I almost thought what was happening when I first watched it was she was like, can I borrow him for a day? And then as she gives him away, they send him a letter like, yeah, we actually have legal rights to him because you're not a fitting parent. So you just gave us your child. And I was like, wait.
No, it wasn't anything like that. It was something that Amelia initially said no to. And then in the second episode, I think she agrees to it.
She relents.
Because she's forced to by circumstance. I can't remember why. But
so she
her dad's wine business completely goes under.
Oh, that's
and
right, Mr. Sedley.
She has
oh
to start
God.
Like Mr. Sedley is what I like to call a business asshole.
yeah, Mr. Sedley is.
But he is a business major gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
But he does his best as well. Like mm-hmm. I can kind of sympathize with him, but. He got screwed really, really bad.
He just is one of those, and we can talk about him more in the second half, I think, but he's just one of those guys who's always got his plan, like, okay, here's my new idea, and they're always bad. Mm-hmm. It's yeah. like, you need to stop and just go get a job somewhere. Yeah. But yeah, the Amelia stuff with her son, and it was really heartbreaking because it's just so shitty that the deal has to be from Mr. Osborne has to be, okay, we'll take care of your son, and that means that you will barely get to see him, you know?
Right.
And that
right.
and that's just born out of Osborne still holding this ridiculous grudge over his son not saying sorry for like running off and marrying Amelia. Because he has this conversation with Dobbin where Dobbin says, hey man. So George is dead. He died in war. His son has nothing. His widow has nothing. Could you help him out?
Like a little bit.
And Mr. Osborne is like, well, he didn't say sorry. So no, I won't. It's like, this is so, it's just, it was frustrating. And yeah. you have to watch
it's
poor
so
Amelia's
salty.
Life be ruined mm-hmm. by this petty old man.
It sounds like we're firmly anti Mr. Osborne in this on
yeah,
this podcast.
Well, yeah, unless what you got a little angle on him?
No, I don't have any acute or obtuse or otherwise. Nothing.
He's deeply Ebenezer Scroogey here.
Yeah.
If we're gonna keep making comparisons,
he's got no ghosts.
Wily and undeserving and hoarding and dreadful. Mm-hmm. If Becky was a man, essentially.
Wow.
I wonder why he has. I wonder why he has a change of heart around, okay, I will support this kid. Like, is that purely Jane sort of pushing him there? Is it about
yeah.
him wanting an heir? Or does he have genuine, like, feelings of protectiveness towards the kid? Is there anything salvageable in him making that choice or no?
Okay. So the thing is, like, I don't think Jane wants to get married. It's been like 7 years, and yeah. Jane is of marriageable age, and she has not gotten
definitely
married.
Wanted to get married to Dobbin. I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, she wanted to get married to Dobbin, but she really isn't on the market.
Yeah.
And he's not interested.
And he's not interested. He's in India, and he's not writing to her.
Mm-mm. God, the India set in the show is so dumb.
Jane got screwed. And if she isn't going to be a wife to a rich and respected colonel, even if he's the son of a grocer, well, essentially her dad also withheld Dobbin from her. He's a greengrocer, and he's below her.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to have Amelia's kid. Like, that's essentially what this is about.
Right.
I'll say we can put the Osborne family stuff on pause because it does come back in the second episode.
Posborne.
We'll do a little Posborne. And my last stray note scene here that we didn't talk about is just in case you forgot that Dobbin still has feelings for Amelia, there is a scene where they come back from war and she's playing with her child and he comes in and he just has this feeling of like, this could have been mine. And she's like, oh, Dobbin, thank you. Like, I'm so glad that you're here. Like, it's so nice to have, like, a father figure in this kid's life. And he's like,
it's so good to have a friend.
A friend to help me raise the kid and do all the chores and help me out, right? Like, that's so nice. And he's like, of course. Dude's melting. Dude's dying over here.
I'm going to talk to my kid about how great George was, my husband. Anyway.
Who's dead, but I loved him the most.
And Dobbin knew exactly what kind of asshole George was.
Yeah.
And he isn't telling Amelia, like, ever.
It's the frustrating thing about...
it would break her. It would ruin her.
It's the it's the infuriating thing about grief sometimes is... and I don't think a lot of media handles this well. It's very rare and surprising when media does handle it well. But when people die, especially like shitty people, it's very rare that people will talk about that. It's almost like dying erases that for you. But like, we need to remember that George was one of the shittiest men in this show. We need to like internalize that. No matter how much Amelia says, like, I miss my husband and I'm never going to marry again. Her husband was awful. End of story. And it sucks that he died, but he died like from a stray bullet from being in the front line of the Battle of Waterloo. Like, you're going to move on. Life is going to go on.
I think the sad thing about George is that he being on the battlefield was good for him as a person.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not saying anything about war being a good thing at all, right? But just being in that space of having camaraderie with other people and witnessing Dobbin risk his life to save somebody else and all this stuff, George actually was starting to be like, oh, empathy. Okay, I see. Mm-hmm. And then in the moment where he thinks, okay, I am going to, you know, be here for other people. I'm going to lead. I'm going to inspire. I'm going to, you know, put myself on the line for the sake of others. That's the moment when he gets shot. So he could have been a better guy if he had lived, maybe. But certainly when he was alive, he was a fuckboy, plain and simple.
But we will dive more into the true depths of fuckboyism in the second episode, unless anybody has any stray notes.
Is there an equivalent for a girl? Because that's what Becky's doing. I guess she could be a fuckboy, too. We can just call her a fuckboy.
Becky is... the word is coquette.
There you go.
Ooh, fancy. Okay.
Meow.
And in... but when I like to me, I'm gonna do the Omens outfit minute at the end of the second episode, I just want to like take a moment to talk about like the fabulous lace baby blankets in this episode, and Amelia being super super unwell and like just looking gorgeous in a white cotton morning dress in beautiful bed linens. And it's just, it's the most beautiful image of this most pathetic and doll-like gullible creature on the planet. And I'm like, I wish I could take care of you, but the world is awful. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. It's an interesting scenario we found ourselves in. if anybody, if forever hold your peace, as we will be taking a brief pause, a brief sabbatical, and when we return, we will discuss the full depths of despair that Vanity Fair is ready to bring us in episode 6, in which a painter's daughter meets a king. Outside in the cold distance. Welcome back to Vanity Chats. The second episode we watched this week was episode 6 of the 2018 Vanity Fair miniseries, in which a painter's daughter meets a king. This one was written, as always, by Gwyneth Hughes, but it was directed by Jonathan Entwistle, a different director for a different kind of dark. In this episode, Magellan, tell me what happened.
In this episode, Becky's time to finally shine arrives as she is introduced to the king. It comes at great cost, though. How will her marriage hold up to the new arrangement she has made?
Arrangement? Okay, so this episode's so dark, right? This is like the darkest episode of the show so far.
It is a stressful one to watch. That's for sure. Yeah.
You just get to watch Becky making worse and worse.
The worst choices ever. Yeah.
In which Becky makes some fucked up decisions. So she literally meets the King of England?
Yes.
They just like shot around that and didn't actually show the dude?
Yeah, they didn't actually show the dude because technically, like, nobody knew what the king was supposed to look like. But at this point, he was like a sad, fat guy.
Yeah.
And God,
I will never forget
his hands.
He did?
Because they had warts all over them and he wanted to make sure they smelled nice when people kissed his ring.
What? What?
Probably
honestly, I respect it.
Warts on their lips, didn't it? Mm.
You get warts anywhere, bud.
Don't you get warts if you kiss a wart? Or is that not how warts work?
That's how it works in fairy tales and in Mario 2.
I mean, a whole bunch of diseases can give you warts, but most commonly syphilis.
I was just thinking about the scene in John Adams where he meets the king, and I got chills because that's like one of the best scenes in that show.
And it's the sad guy from Pride and Prejudice. And
it all comes back, baby. It all comes back.
There are like 20 of them. There's a new 20, but for that era, there's like 20. And
20 kings?
Not kings, but 20. Actors that you see in everything. Mm-hmm. And to the point where my parents will like list out the 20 and call them the 20 when we're talking about like a 1990s British period drama.
That's funny. Mm-hmm.
So
that guy, whoever he is definitely on it.
Yes, the guy from that.
And I don't know his actual name. I don't know anyone's actual name anymore.
I don't know my own actual name.
I have the short-term memory of a goldfish. But Vanity Fair episode 2, they cut around her meeting the king, and she's just overjoyed.
I want to get there because it's one of the dopest scenes of the episode. Where she says, I've arrived. I love that. Before we get there, our man, Lord Pitt himself, has a new young hot lady friend named Betsy. And you're like, wow, Betsy's going to be so important. Her and Pitt are going to go on an event. And then he dies.
Yeah. He died doing what he loves, which is chasing around young women in a very creepy way.
He's being ribald as usual. And then he dies. His like heart just gives out. He's done. It's a bummer.
And then, his wife isn't even that fazed by it.
Yeah, I bet you she knew. She was kind of just waiting for it to happen. But then we get introduced to another toxic relationship, which is Steen and Becky. And Steen, continuing to look like a vampire in combat armor, literally jingles a shiny necklace in front of Becky to steal her away from Rodden. Like, she is a cat with keys. He's like, you know, you could have this if you got with me, you know, Becky. And she's like, well, I'll have to think about it. Which is just, again, saying the quiet part out loud. Becky will do anything for a quick buck. I wrote in my notes
It's not just a quick buck, right? It's access to the sort of like upper echelons of society and being able to say that she's met the king and stuff like that. It's not just like, oh, jewels
money.
Valuable. It's the symbol of the jewels and stuff.
And what Becky thinks is respectability.
Yeah.
But really kind of isn't.
Yeah, a bunch of couples get paraded around and they all get to say hi to the king for 5 seconds and leave. Like, being rich sounds like it sucks.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is sort of like Becky's overjoyed by it, but to everyone else, it's like, oh, I have to go to the opera and do this thing. And it's just not fun anymore. And they're all bored and they can't get out. Mm-hmm. And Becky doesn't realize what kind of a deal with the devil she's making and how much they're going to shut her out because of who she is.
Mm-hmm. There is, speaking of rich people, And people talking about being rich. I would love the context of this line that I wrote down from Martha Crowley, the icon. She says, I simply have no idea how much money it costs to be rich. And I know that Becky later gets mad at her for saying this, but I don't remember why they were meeting up. Can somebody recall that for me?
They were meeting up because What's-Her-Face died. Or Sir Pitt died.
No, Sir Pitt died.
Sir Pitt died and Martha was hosting the funeral.
Oh.
And all of the servants were dressed in black crepe and all of the mirrors were veiled and they were at his funeral at their house. Mm-hmm. And Martha uses this time of extreme mourning to just taunt Becky. And it's utterly heinous. Just again, like a quick note, because my brain just can't shut up about it. Martha is the only correctly dressed married lady in this place. She's the only one who's wearing a cap, and if she were in mourning, it would be black crepe. And I think, is she wearing her like still white muslin cap?
I believe she is. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. No. She's out of mourning.
She doesn't feel that bad.
She doesn't feel that bad.
Yeah. It could be. It can definitely be outfit as storytelling, which is always fun.
Yeah,
I was doing a gag.
Especially Becky is the one that's playing accurately with the veil over her face.
Right, there you go. And then there was a scene that Magellan mentioned earlier that is kind of funny in its execution, which is Amelia selling precious items to afford food, begging people for money, but attempting to make any money back. And we just hard cut to Becky, like, it's seemingly 5 feet away, but not literally, being like, ooh, I'll take this expensive hat and this pretty dress and this one. Like, we are reaching a level of heightened contrast that has become a little absurd, and I like it.
Yeah, and she is at her dressmaker, and I know, and like Amelia is still sort of in the same place. That was you see her looking in this dressmaker's shop window, and then it's a cut scene. Yes, to Becky, like 5 feet away.
Yes, yes.
Just in the shop, but it's kind of implied, like everything in that shop window is pink. Amelia is usually dressed by the lighting in either pink or blue, depending on how warm or cool the lighting is and what the mood they want to set. But it's almost, I think, like a symbol of her former life. And Becky is just in there spending frivolously and forgetting her.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting and tiring.
But it's not that heartbreaking yet.
It's not heartbreaking yet, but you sort of get the inkling of like, yeah, Amelia needs somebody to take care of her and nobody cares about her enough to do that.
Yeah, and over the course of the episode, it becomes increasingly frustrating to think about how much money Becky is hoarding and wasting. And if she cared for Amelia at all, Amelia would be fine, right? She wouldn't have any problems. Becky could easily provide for her, take her in, whatever it is. And there's
she
just would
have been able to pay her debts because she cared about other people too.
Yeah. And there's just Becky never gestures towards that. She never thinks about Amelia or writes to her or anything. When Amelia took her in when she needed it, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It sucks.
It does. And we do another cut to India. This doesn't seem like it's super important right now. I just thought that the India set was really funny because it was just an interior that was like, we're not going to do the stereotypical thing of like, look outside, it's the jungle and elephants. Like, no, we're not trying to do that shit. Instead, it's just like a really beautiful space and Joss and Dobbin are having a great time. And as I understood it, is Miss O'Dowd's daughter here?
Yep.
Glorvina O'Dowd, which is a really
young younger sister, technically.
Oh, okay. And does she seems to have a crush on Dobbin?
Yeah, they get married, I think. I think they get married off screen.
I didn't actually pick up on that.
There's like a throwaway line of dialogue when you're in the Sedley household later where they mention it. And Amelia's parents give each other a look of like, God dang it, she could have married that guy. Oh, man.
She didn't marry that guy also kind of.
Well, and it's a sort of, I think...
He forced her into a relationship with George, even though he doesn't really love her, and now it's biting us in the ass. Oh, crap.
I don't think they even feel, like, regret. I think they more so exchange a look of, like, our daughter is so oblivious to the fact that this man constantly sends her gifts and writes her letters all the time and is clearly in love with her. They're just kind of like, come on, Amelia. Yeah. Don't you get it? And we also learn from both sides of that in the India scenes and at home that Joss has been sending money home to support the family. But Mr. Sedley has been wasting that money on his various business ventures.
Oh, the scene.
Yeah. And so it's weird. Like, it's strange to me because it seems like Joss could also solve their problems. And
or at least
maybe,
help.
Yeah. And like, I guess he's trying to. I guess he is sending money home.
But so Mr. Sedley's using it for his business ventures.
Yeah, so I
and
guess
not
Joss
actually
is
providing
good,
for
right?
his family. It's going into loan sharks and creditors because Mr. Yeah. Sedley is a business asshole.
Right. Right.
And just does not actually, like, he cares about his family, but he's putting more faith in these people that won't actually help him than the income his son provides.
Yeah, it's almost like a pride thing, right? Like, he doesn't want to provide for his family with money that was given to him by his son. He wants to provide for his family with money that he earned with his great idea or whatever. Yeah, and that's not so cool.
Part of the thing, though, is Mr. Sedley is old. He's, like, 70, and Joss is, like, 30, and... Shouldn't you want to retire and let your children support you?
You would hope. That whole scene is just really intense and kind of difficult to watch where her mother, like, she's complaining about her mother for being like her parenting style. And she's like, I'm just trying to help you. And then they're like, oh, you got money from Joss, or we just found out you got money from Joss. Where is it going? The dad reveals like, oh, I've been spending it. And it's not just like he's not like gambling it away. That's the thing that makes this complicated is he's like, I'm actually just trying to shore up all the debts that I accrued from borrowing too much money. Like, I can't break even such that I can support you guys. So instead, I'm just shoring up my debts. And sometimes
but
actually
I think he's also continuing to borrow money.
Making more. Yes. Yes.
Too.
But that's the nature of debt, right? Is you don't really get out of it because every time you borrow, you're also adding exacerbating the issue, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So he's trapped in that prison. They're all in their own prison of sorts. You could say that that's what this episode is about in a broad sense, is different people being trapped by various circumstances involving money. And Rodden and Becky are trapped in the loop with Steen. He's like, you guys are going to go to meet the king. The light floods to Becky's face, and she says, I've arrived. And it's like, if the show ended here, I guess we'd be fine. I guess it's like, well, Becky really screwed over a lot of people. They got this gambling den. Her son doesn't ever see her. Her husband feels neglected. Everyone hates her. But it's fine. She got what she wanted. She's done, right? She's not done. Because power comes at a cost. And it becomes clear that Steen is asking for something in return. That evening, at least, I think he... Not
they
implies.
Do, they do sex. They do sex to each other.
Yeah.
They definitely do
that's
that.
That's the your payment.
He takes off her necklace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he says, now it's time for the sex for me. As if I remember correctly, I think I wrote that line down.
Yeah.
I think the episode does a good job of unfolding that plot piece by piece, allowing you to figure it out. And then it says, yes, you're right. That's what's going on. Because at the end of the previous episode, we don't know a thing about Steen. We don't know his name. We don't know anything about him. We just know that he is a guy who comes in. He's got a whole vibe. He walks up to Becky, gives her a look. She gives him a smile. And you're left at the end of the previous episode to wonder, oh, God, what happened in the time jump? Who is this character? And then in the scene earlier when they're in the parlor and Becky has I don't remember her name, but it's the woman who was working previously for Matilda and now is working for them.
Briggs.
Yeah, Briggs. She gets her to leave the room. And then there's this thing where he's like, you're mine, right? Da 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 da. And so I was sitting there like, oh no, are they having some kind of affair? Is that what's happening? And then in that scene, they basically turn to camera and are like, by the way, we're having an affair. Now we're going to have sex with each other.
Yeah,
but that's what's going on.
It's more affecting because they're not trying to hide it from you. It's not a reveal. It's just a confirmation of what was like festering in your head.
Yeah. And I think it works well because they give you just enough to figure it out. And then they confirm it as opposed to like showing you the buildup of it in the time that we skipped.
And we get this really, really, really intense ghoulish scene in the evening by the piano where for a moment it's like, does Rodden know? Because before when she leaves, it's like, oh, I don't think Rodden knows. She comes back and the guy clearly knows. He says, you don't leave without me anymore. You don't go to social gatherings without me anymore. It's sort of as a last ditch attempt to be like, it's because we're together, but also because I know what you're doing when we're not together. Yeah. And she is, there's this incredible, I need to know how they made this work with the camera, where they lie in bed together. They're in bed together, but the camera like uses a mirror to cover up Rodden and replace him with Becky's reflection. So yeah, it just looks cool like she's lying in bed with herself.
Yeah.
You made your bed and now lie in it. Like it's really good work. This show occasionally like flexes the cinematography in ways that I love. But yeah, it gets worse. So
yeah, it's go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was gonna jump to the next big scene.
Oh, I just Rodden as a character I find really intriguing in this episode because you go on the journey of seeing what it is that he's willing to forgive and ignore and what it is that he isn't. Mm-hmm. And he basically knows what's going on. Like, you're getting all of this random new jewelry. You can somehow pay our servants. We're getting invited to all these parties and this guy is there all the time. You came home really late. Like, I'm not stupid, Becky. I put all the pieces together. It's making you happy. So just can I be with you, please? And can you stop? And he's content with saying that, basically tacitly saying like, whatever you've done, let's wipe the slate clean and just do things in a way that's more comfortable for me going forward. Mm-hmm. And then even after that point, she just continues to
And
betray
Rodden
him.
Loves her. He has no hard feelings from her for this.
Right.
He just wants everything to be over and for her to love him.
Because
he thinks she used to love him. It's a toss up as to whether or not that's actually true. I think she used to love him.
I think there was affection there. I think
there are arguments that there was not like that she absolutely didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
just using him.
You definitely can see the contrast between how she treated him at the beginning with how she's treating Lord Steen, where like she clearly does not love Lord Steen in any sort of way. She's playing him 100% of the time. Whereas with Rodden, she sort of wanted him to be her partner in crime. And for a while, he was. But then he just wanted to get out of the game. And she was like, no, we're still playing the game, baby. There's still much to do. And that's kind of where it fell off. So I don't even know if that was like love so much as, yeah, what you both are saying, affection or some kind of sense of partnership or whatever that went away.
He's one of the people who understands her a little bit, and there's something still valuable about that in their relationship.
True.
Because we see her later going to a party, and you know, as so many of these 1800 stories like to tell us, and stories in general, I don't even think this is a time thing. Bad deeds show on your face. You can't hide sin, no matter how hard you try, no matter how much you bury it and lie to people. She's at this fancy party. Steen's wife is here. The Bear Acres are here. It's really funny to think that years and years later, not only are they still like in high society and still going to the same parties, but they still hate Becky. And they're basically suggesting that all the other women are like, oh, she's just another one of Steen's girls. Like, he's going to throw her away like he throws away everyone else. As if several of them have been in this position, which is really fucked.
Yeah.
Because he's the kind of guy who walks into that party and asks people to compliment him on the party, and they do it, and they clap for him, because that's the sort of power that he has. His whole shtick, as I understand it, is about control and power, the way that so many abusive men can be, is just, I want to be able to say that I did this for you, and you're going to thank me for it. And we actually meet Lady Steen here, which I thought was really valuable, talking about how, like, everyone hates him, but they're all just jealous. And the most important thing, Becky, is never get to lose your husband. Don't lose Rodden, no matter what. Which Becky does not understand. she does not succeed here. She tries to recall the old times back in episode 3, which feels like 100 years ago. And she calls him Booby. Like, oh, Booby, we're going to the party. We're having fun at the party. Don't you want to go home later? And he says, I'm leaving now. And we get a kind of scary scene where you forget, like, when there aren't streetlights, how scary it must be to walk alone at night, because Rodden leaves this party and he's intercepted in the night. I thought he was going to, like, just get killed or something. But it's worse. He gets intercepted by a bunch of bailiffs who are collecting on basically Becky's debts that are going through him.
Yeah, to the dressmaker. It's like a small bill.
Yeah.
And Becky or Rodden doesn't know exactly how much she's playing Steen. So he goes to debtor's prison for a night.
Yeah, he spends the night in prison for his wife.
Oh, that sucked. Oh,
Because of the dress that she doesn't even need. She just wanted a nice dress. And the dressmaker needs to get paid, so he sends a bailiff. They put him in debtor's prison. And he's like, it's okay, Becky will pay off my debt, right? And he writes her this amazing letter, and we see her read it. We see her pull up the letter, and he says, babe, I'm in prison. I'm going to be here overnight. It's because of the dress thing. I'm not even that mad. Can you just pay this and get me out, please? This really sucks. We'll have to talk about this later. Yeah. She puts it down and goes to go hang out with Steen. She puts it down. She reads it and goes, I'll read this later. Let me put this in my to-do list.
Like, and there's no emotion from that at all. It's just all about the play. There is this man in my parlor. I need to play him.
I have other things to worry about than my literal husband and father of my child.
Yeah, and whereas she has enough money to fully settle this debt.
Mm-hmm. And
it's not even like send a servant with some banknotes.
Mm-hmm. It's not an expensive debt. That's what makes this so. That's one of the things that really puts the final nail in. Is
yeah,
it's not like he's in for $1 million.
Yeah, that's what Rodden ultimately is upset about when he comes. His brother bails him out, and his brother's like, "Did you tell your wife?" And he's like, shut up.
Stop.
Leave me alone. He goes home. He walks in on Steen and Becky.
This is the moment.
And Rodden is not, I mean, obviously he's upset about her being with another man, but he didn't walk in on them in bed together, right? It wasn't that sort of like hacky, tropey scene of how could you do what? The things that he's upset about are the jewels and being left in debtor's prison, and then ultimately when he finds the money, that's the stuff that bothers him so much more than like Steen and anything that has to do with him. Because otherwise he would have gone ham on that guy. And instead he just, you know, did a little squaring up and a little like, get out of here, man.
Cool. F you, bro.
He, like, Rodden doesn't like to hold grudges. Rodden has good intentions for people and likes to see the good in people.
Right.
And that is ultimately the reason why Becky is able to play him so hard.
Yeah.
He's not able to be like, yo, I love you, but you're being really shitty and you're treating our kid like crap.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of become her lapdog / doormat.
Yeah. I also thought it was telling that Steen in that moment says, oh, I get it. You both are scamming me, you know, getting money from me, and then you just spend it and pretend like he took it and spent it or whatever. I see what's going on here. And Rodden doesn't correct him. He doesn't say, what are you talking about? Or try to clear his name or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't really matter to him either. He doesn't care how people like Steen perceive him. He doesn't care about this high society stuff. He doesn't care about like reputation or respectability or whatever. He just wants this guy out of his house so he can have his wife and have his son and it's be happy.
That's all he wants.
Instead, there's just this like this scheme that he uncovers. And the moment where he opens the box and finds all the money and he's like, Becky, what the fuck?
Well, not before. Because Rodden does go a little sicko mode here in a really great scene, right? He like grabs...
Where he like rips the jewels off, right?
He grabs Steen by the neck and then calls him villain and thief and slaps him twice, knocks him to the fucking floor.
True. Yeah, that's true.
Becky gets all hot and bothered, like, wait, this is good, right? And she says, how could I turn our Patreon?
And then I heard Anthony Stewart Head say a word I never thought I'd hear him say. where he goes, pimp. And like runs away. Pimp.
Gets Wait, what?
When he leaves, the last thing he says to Rodden is pimp. And then Rodden throws the jewels in his face and says, get out of my house.
Pimp. Pimp.
Yeah. Pimp. Which is just a word you don't. That's like Giles. A
British man. Pimp.
That's Giles. Oh, God. Giles.
He leaves bleeding. And then Rodden cracks into the secret stash of money. And he's like, he goes, where's the key? And then like breaks the thing. Oh, he's like, I don't need the key. And he finds all this money. He's like, you really just had all of this, right? Thousands of banknotes that you didn't ever want to give to me. And you like, you'd rather have me sit in debtor's prison than any of this.
Uh-huh.
He says 100 of this would have made me a free man. I love this scene so freaking much, dude. It's so well lit. They're both wearing really black.
Yeah.
It's like it's a really play. Great.
And that is a moment of genuine surprise, I think, for me as an audience member. Like, I probably could have guessed that Becky had the stash of money, but that was a moment where it actually wasn't this, like, painfully obvious thing. It was kind of a revelation to me, too, of, oh, my God, she really was keeping around a lot of money. I thought that she was spending it all on whatever, but the fact that she just was keeping it in a box and not telling him about it and not using it for anything – was like kind of surprising and tells you a whole lot about what Becky's motivations are and what she wants.
She's hoarding the money to have money and then not paying her debts.
Yeah.
And somehow she thinks that accruing all this debt and owing people is okay because when she gets more money, she'll pay it off. And then that never happens.
And I think I was going to ask you more about what you both thought of this, like where we're supposed to go from here, because the episode actually makes a good musical choice. It ends on a cover of Joy Division's "Love Will Tear Us Apart," which is a song from 1980 that is very, very beautiful original, and this cover is pretty good, which suggests almost to me that like there is still a story of love to be had either between Becky and Rodden or between somebody on this show. I don't know. I don't know if Rodden just dips after this, like pays off the debts and says, no, screw you or what. But I don't know. What do y'all think?
Yeah, there are ways that Becky is definitely going to get her comeuppance and she is going to be destitute.
Yeah.
Dobbin is going to... maybe rescue her. I don't know. Can't say that for a fact. I know that Amelia and Becky meet for one more time. And I know that Thackeray doesn't like when people end a story in complete desperation.
Okay.
So he doesn't like his, like, hard, gritty endings. He's not Dickens.
Yeah, he's not doing the, like, noir thing where it's like, oh, it's kind of corrupt all the way down. I guess that's the end of it. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, there's more to it than that, very much so. This is romanticism at its heart.
I dig it. Yeah. I vibe with that. Magellan, what do you think? Where do you think we're going from here?
Well, something good has to happen for Rodin and the son, right?
Yeah.
They need to sort of move on to better things. Maybe he gets like a really great wife who's very nice or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Just they deserve better. I mean, I think it's a thing where every character who deserves better, you know, ends up better off. I'm curious, are we talking specifically about like the Rod and Becky stuff or just overall predictions for the last episode?
At this point, we have one episode left. I would say overall predictions are good.
Something has to happen with Dobbin and Amelia. There has to be some kind of revelation there. I don't know what that leads to necessarily, but Amelia needs to learn that Dobbin loved her the whole time, and probably is going to learn it when it's too late for that to be anything, or maybe she wouldn't want to be anything anyway. But yeah. And then Becky, who knows what's going to happen with Becky? I don't know. Maybe she won't ever learn a lesson, you know? Maybe she'll just scheme till she dies.
That's sort of what I think. Not when I said destitute in part one, I more meant like, you know, has one final chance and she's just not doing well for herself. Like, they have to flip one more time. Amelia needs a win and Becky needs a significant loss beyond what we've seen here.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I agree. In terms of stray notes, like, Becky hit her kid.
She did.
Yeah.
There is like she is a terrible mother, and it goes beyond like having really crappy parents and not knowing how to raise children.
Yeah. She's not just neglectful. She was like, I don't love you or whatever. Or the son says, I hate you. And she said something like, the feeling's mutual. And like slapped him in the face. It's horrible. It's really bad. That's one of the worst things she does, if not the worst thing.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like Rodden's a big boy. Obviously he's sad, but he seems to be able to compartmentalize it and sort of say like, oh, okay. It turns out you sucked this whole time. So goodbye. But obviously for a kid, that is not
really
something
hard
that a kid can do.
And you contrast that with George, who has been forcibly removed from his loving mother by someone who is cruel.
Yeah, and he's just like, bye, Mom. See you later.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll talk more about this when we talk about the finale, but it's going to be weird for me after we watch this show, like, recommending it to people, because it's in this weird space, right, where if you've never seen or read Vanity Fair, then you check this out and you're like, oh, that's really fun and exciting and like dramatic and it was so interesting and I learned so much. I'm sure people like hardcore fans of the original book are pissed. I know that for a fact. I've read reviews of the show that are like, they didn't even try to be faithful to the book. It cuts out so much good stuff, which is every adaptation does that. If they didn't cut stuff out, then the show would be like 8 hours long each episode. Like, come on, guys. But I'm just curious, like, when you recommend this to people, who are you recommending it to? Is that just fans of period pieces? Because that's kind of why I chose to watch it. Or, you know, fans of the original novel or what?
Yeah,
it fits an interesting space.
Sorry, I'm choosing sort of to recommend this to people who like period dramas and not really people who are fans of the book. Like, I don't really know the book super well, but I do like period dramas, and it's fun. It's really amusing. And it would be a good, like, Saturday night, my knitting and, like, some popcorn read or watch. And nothing is bad, really, about it. Except for maybe
competent.
The music choices.
Yeah.
But it's not, like, objectively terrible. So...
But I think we can save our the rest of our overall thoughts for the finale. Because we still have one more episode of Vanity Fair to watch, folks.
Yes.
Episode 7. Magellan, can you tell me the summary of the final episode of Vanity Fair, please?
Are we not going to talk about Amelia? I guess we did talk about Amelia losing her son. And like,
oh, we have two things to talk about. I'm sorry. We have two things. We have Amelia losing her son. Yes. Go ahead.
Well, just like, I don't know, the scene where she's like clinging to him in bed, like, oh, no, sweet George. Oh, crying. I don't know. I guess there's not much more to say, but it was really sad. I feel like we didn't really talk about Amelia that much.
Well, I think Amelia has a little bit more juice in the tank. Like, so I need something to happen more with her besides. Like, it's a lot of tragedy.
Yeah, she's and the being real stuff is sad and sappy all the time, and she doesn't really have very much agency, and she needs to have a moment where she, like, makes a decision.
Yeah, true.
And then we also need to do Omen's outfit minute.
Yeah, that's the second thing. Thank you. Go ahead. It's time for the Omen's Costume Corner.
Omen's Costume Corner.
Omen's Costume Corner.
So I want to first point out Amelia's like lovely invalid mourning outfit.
Mm-hmm.
In episode 5, she's dressed in pure white, and she goes from pure white, this like roughly muslin affair, to just solid black wool and crepe. And it's a wonderful transformation. She doesn't get out of black ever. She is 7 years on and still in deep, deep mourning because she's a widow and she doesn't want to remarry. When she would want to remarry, her clothing would change to include more gray and violet before then like transitioning to normal colors. Widows who don't remarry are kind of expected to stay in black.
Yep. And this is still a tradition in some cultures, by the way.
And in this period. And because she's so young, that's part of the reason why her family's encouraging her to remarry. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of anachronisms in terms of who is wearing what when. Becky keeps wearing that teal evening dress in the middle of the day with her decollete just hanging out among all of these conservative married women. No wonder they hate her.
She's showing off all the goods, basically.
Yes, she is a hussy.
Oh, wow.
And she's behaving, and she's not even like dressing appropriately for the daytime. It would be like if I went to work in a gold lamé jumpsuit.
Whoa. Like you're trying to turn heads.
Yes, like she's trying to turn heads. Yeah. Like it's a moment. It's a okay. Good outfit though, and she later transitions into the peacock blue pelisse.
Yep.
She was in Amelia's pink for a while, and that was her initial play, and then she immediately switched to like blue and green and like purples, and I think that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that we see her in some contrasting colors as she loses her fortune again. But overall, that's pretty much what I wanted to say. Also, every married woman should technically be dressed like Peggy O'Dowd.
Really?
Just with the hair and the cap and the high up collar.
Oh.
You don't get to have boobs unless you're not married.
Damn.
Anyway, sucks for me. No, that's it. Sorry. That's all I want to say.
Well, thank you, Omens. I appreciate the costume corner. It's always a wonderful segment. I know. And that's another one of the things that people criticize about the show is that, like you said, some of the outfits are just like, this looks cool.
And I can appreciate that. That's why Bridgerton exists. You have a pretty princess ball scene with some glitter and some sheer. It's fantastic. It's amazing. I respect the artistic choices, but it's still not the best.
Did we talk about Steen's wife at all?
We mentioned her briefly, yeah. No, we mentioned her.
Oh, yeah, we mentioned her, but we don't really know very much about her yet.
I think that's the last thing that I really was thinking about with this episode. It's just her as a character. I find her interesting, and like it was a question mark for me of how much she knew about his dalliances with other women in that moment where he leans in to the wife and to Becky and says like, you're the only true woman in London or whatever. And it's like, wife. Oh, who's well,
to
but,
his wife, yeah, or no, well, to, he, it's ambiguous for a sec.
Right, it's ambiguous who he says it to. Like, obviously, he's saying it to his wife, but he's really saying it to Becky.
Yeah.
And it was just interesting to watch her throughout those scenes and see her be the only person who's kind to Becky in that whole room. And also, like, maybe she knows what's going on. I don't know. But
yeah,
I just thought she was.
We're not really able to be sure, like, whether it's because she knows what's going on and she's trying to play Becky, or because she, like, actually feels bad that Becky's ostracized.
I think it's probably the latter. She feels bad.
Valid.
But yeah, I the thing I said earlier about Steen's wife that I liked was when she goes, Becky, you need to hold on to your husband as tight as you can. A woman is nothing without her husband. Mm-hmm. And she's saying this about Steen, who clearly doesn't love her. Like, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
She's that's a very valuable character to have. Like, remind us that Steen is not just this Giles vampire evil guy. He also, well, he is that, but also, like, has a wife and exists in society beyond just his wheeling and dealing.
Yeah, and his wife has a duty to, like, take care of him and to maintain her own position so she can't call him out for his crap.
Right.
I mean, in a way, she is the Rodden, like the gender flip of how Rodden is to Becky, where it's like, I need you for your status, and I need you to tell me yes when I want to do things, and that's basically how I'm planning to use you. Yeah.
She could also be called, like, she's also almost a more passive Becky. Like, you can do this, but I'm going to keep my position because it's advantageous.
Yeah, if Becky just sat on the money and didn't, like, continue to steal, she would be more of a Steen's
wife.
And
Steen doesn't steal. He just screws around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's a really, really dense and good episode. I highly recommend it. People are just listening to us discuss it. You should, if you can get to this one, you should be watching along because, oh, boy. Oh, boy. I came out of it very stressed out. I had initially watched the first one. Like, I usually will watch one on Saturday and then one Sunday morning before we record. But Magellan was like, you're probably not going to be able to stop watching when you start the second one. And I was like, oh, just 5 minutes. And then I fell into it. And then we got to the gambling scene. And I was like, oh, I can't. I watched all one night. And then I watched The Muppets instead. Magellan, can you tell me about the last episode of Vanity Fair, por favor?
Sure. Next week, we are watching episode 7 of Vanity Fair, which is entitled Endings and Beginnings. Becky is lost, and then she's found, but will she have a happy ending?
No, dude! Maybe, dude!
Yeah, who knows? We'll find out.
And again, like, depends on your definition of happy.
And ending, right?
Yeah.
How about that? Wow.
Very exciting stuff. I think that brings us to everybody's favorite segment of Chats the Television Podcast. It's the plug zone. The zone of plugs. Magellan, can you give us the rundown, please, sir?
Sure, I would love to. So if you'd like to get in touch with the show, there are a couple ways to do that. You can email us, chatspod@gmail.com, with your thoughts on this season, if you want to hear those emails read on the show. If your thoughts on what you think we should watch next or just whatever you want to email us, we welcome those emails. You can also follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/chatspod, and you can DM us there as well if that's your thing. You can join a community of fellow listeners in one of two ways, actually. The first is by going on to reddit.com/r/chatspod, where your fellow chatsies are listening to old chats seasons. At this point, I don't want to do the math of where we are. If we're doing Avatar The Last Airbender, I think that's what's happening right now. By the time this is coming out.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So that's going on. You can also join fellow listeners if you are a part of our Patreon and then hop on into the Discord server. And that's fun. Talk about TV, put some GIFs in there, talk about, you know, the news, TV news, that kind of thing. So it's a good time. And also sometimes we record episodes live in the Discord as well. And you can hop in and join the chat and stuff. So there's all that. Speaking of the Patreon, if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do so at $1, $3, or $5 a month. $1 gets you access to some random, cool, fun bonus things that we put out here and there, a couple commentaries, a couple other episodes, as well as my solo episodes on the X-Files. $3 gets you access to our regular thrice-monthly bonus content, which could be film commentaries, us piloting new shows, or just whatever the heck we feel like. Discussions, structured or unstructured. And then $5 you do because you love us and we love you and we appreciate it very much. And then if you would like to support the show in non-financial ways, we're always looking to expand our listenership, which happens through reviews. It happens through sharing the show with your friends and family. So doing either of those things, we really appreciate that as well. But that's the show plugs. And then, you know, instead of personal plugs, although, Omens, you have personal plugs? What's your personal
plug? Not really.
Okay. All right. So in lieu of personal plugs, we do media recommendations, chatsums, things to snack on between now and next week. So, Omens, you're the guest. Do you have a chatsum for this week?
Okay. So I'm not sure if either of you know what this is, but... Revolutions podcast is back.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the history podcast.
Part of it was going to end at the beginning of quarantine when Mike Duncan finished the Russian Revolution. But then quarantine happened right as...
and he was like, whoa, there are more of these.
Right as part one ended. And then it was like, wait, no, quarantine happened and there's more to everything. And I want to continue this.
Cool.
So it's happening indefinitely now, which makes me very happy because I was trying to figure out how to ration podcast.
Nice.
Either way, good show. I highly recommend.
Dope.
I love Dope. Revolutions, and as long as we keep making them, he can keep making episodes. So let's... No.
Alan, what about you?
Hi, I'm Alan. I was just eating my own chatsum, if you will, which was a Thin Mint. So I guess a soft chatsum to Girl Scout cookies, but a hard recommendation... of
two Girl Scout cookies in the fridge. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. Oh, I should put some of these Thin Mints in the fridge, actually. That wouldn't be a bad idea. You're right. Thanks, Magellan.
Welcome.
No, I am continuing my journey of getting in shape and watching anime on the treadmill. And my current treadmill anime is the 2011 adaptation of the manga Nichijo, which is, how can I describe it? It's sort of like if the Animaniacs were a bunch of high school girls. And they had a bunch of different stuff.
Is it Shoujo-ai?
Yeah. I don't know what that is.
It's like a soft Yuri.
No, there's no like romance in it. Well, there is romance, but not like in the Yuri way.
Okay.
Basically, Nichijou, there are these three students, these three high school students, and they go about their life. Nichijou, the word means ordinary life. And it masters that comedic timing where something is normal and then something bad happens and you overreact to it. Like, for example, one of them is like drawing something. She's helping her friend make a manga. She pricks her finger with the pen by accident and the pointy side hits her thumb. She screams and the scream explodes, passes through the atmosphere, out of the earth, through the solar system. And then it zooms out and it's a blood drop on her finger. And she's like, ow. Just absurdism taken to the extreme. It is laughs a minute, the funniest, one of the funniest anime I've seen in my lifetime. I'm coming to it really late. Like I said, the show is like 10 years old, but it holds up so very, very well. It's 26 episodes. It's on all the regular anime platforms. I'm not just going to like spoil all the jokes, but if you could, the show is definitely like clippable because they're all little segments, you know, they're all little like 5-10 minute segments. And it's just so funny. Like, you can watch some clips on YouTube and see what you think of it. Maybe it's not for everyone, but it's very... And when it decides to be heartfelt, it succeeds in that, too. And there's a robot girl and her little teenage... Or, like, toddler scientist who built her. And the robot girl has, like, a big key on the back of her back. And she's like, can you get rid of the key so I can be a normal girl? And they have a whole thing, and they have a cat that talks, and it's so... It's good, y'all. You gotta watch it. Can you watch it? Thanks. Nichijou, it's a fantastic show. I'm coming to it very late, but it's really good. Megan, what do you got?
I've got a couple video game ones from just things that I've played in this past week. So first off, the other night, me, Alan, our friend Jim, and one of our friends, our friend Jim's friends, played Monaco.
Oh yeah,
because it's on the Switch now. We used to play it on the PC when it was on PC when it first came out. So we're revisiting it, and that game is just it's very fun. It's sort of a top down. It's a heist game. So it's like sort of a stealth game, but actually it's being stealthy is not that important. And they're like different characters with different roles and powers. So one character can like put the guards to sleep. One character can deactivate a ton of the electrical equipment and stuff. And so it's just fun because it's the kind of game that really, it tempts you to be chaotic and to just sort of go by impulse, but then it punishes you severely for doing that. So you have to learn how to cooperate with one another and actually like do the heist in a heist way. Mm-hmm. So Monaco's really fun. I've also been playing a bit of this game, Monster Sanctuary, which came out end of 2020, I think. And it's billed as...
August 2019 initially.
Oh, really? It's just mm-hmm. the Switch version is new?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Okay. And it's just, it's billed as like Pokemon meets Metroidvania. So it's this like 2D platformy. You like gather monsters and they fight in your party in a sort of JRPG kind of way. Mm. And it's interesting. I don't know that I'm giving it like a hard recommend. It's definitely so much more like a JRPG or a Metroidvania than it is like Pokemon. Really the only Pokemon-esque thing is that there are monsters that do attacks, and they have types, and those types, are resistant to or effective against one another. But it's, I don't know. I've been having fun. It's kind of cute. I like finding new creatures and putting them on my team.
I personally love creatures. This game was developed by a small indie team in Germany and published, get
by
this.
Team 17, right?
Yeah, the Worms developers.
Yeah, the Worms people, yeah. So that's pretty fun. And then I've been playing a lot of Smash Ultimate with my roommate Charlie, and we've been devising, just sitting around trying to devise new ways to play that game. So I would just recommend people go back to Smash Ultimate and try to get creative with how you play it. He had this one game mode that he used to play called Yoshimbo, where everybody is on a team with a Yoshi that is sort of their like defender.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's some fun chaos. It's just, I've been really enjoying how versatile Smash can be when you break out of the like Fox versus Fox Final Destination no items mm-hmm. joke and instead explore all the systems that game has to offer. So, yeah.
I dig it, folks. I dig it a lot. I dig it so hard that I've dug to the other side and I've arrived in sunny Beijing, China. Thank you so much to Magellan and Omens for being the rocks to my hard place. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Vanity Chats. Stay sharp.